Yesterday, I did this workshop in Carmel with a physicist on Buddhism and science. And I thought that we might have a little debate about what I was going to kind of propose to be something like epistemological idealism, like that we can only know. That everything we can't know anything outside our experience versus materialism. I was kind of thinking, well, science, especially physics, is about physical material things, and but it turns out that this physicist had a pretty much mind-only view. It seemed to me that he actually he even said very eloquently at one point, physicists actually really come to see quite clearly that we can't actually know of any physical material world outside our senses and experience, and what we have, all we have to go on is our senses. So we're not actually positing anything about any truth about reality. In fact, we see less and less of such. So that was quite wonderful to see the connection between these two seemingly very different traditions. And also in the realm of science, this was some article I found from last time I was studying this. I think it's 2004, so it's probably a lot's happened since then, from the New Scientist magazine. And the article is called "The Concepts Are There Even If the Words Aren't." So these are some scientists that did these experiments on infants before language in different cultures, where they have these Korean babies and English-speaking babies, because there's different concepts in these two languages about the way certain objects fit together. I won't go into the whole thing, but they picked this specific and kind of subtle concept and tested these babies that, well, basically at the end it says here, one of the researchers said, "Some people suggest that babies don't have full-blown concepts. They wait until language imposes categories on them. But we specifically took a linguistic concept and find that it does exist before language. While she has no doubt that language influences how we think, she says it seems to draw attention to certain relationships between objects that we already understand, rather than shaping new ways of thinking about objects. There's a huge debate now about the role that language plays in the formations of concepts." So that's what they were looking into. And basically, the sutra seems to be implying that the words are what make the concepts and are very connected to, but just the mind-only tradition itself, this seems in accord with this article. This is not from the sutra directly, but later tradition says that even without a name for something, we already have a sense of its being naturally suitable to be the basis of a name. Even as babies, I think before language, that's what the proposal is, that this delusion, actually, that we think things are what we think they are, we can do before language. Thus, this ignorance affects every sentient being, even those such as animals and human babies who do not use terminology. So that's a little correlation between science and this sutra also, and this system. Also, so today I feel like we're halfway through this chapter 6, and we have a couple more classes with this, a lot of stuff in chapter 7. So I'd like to ask that today, like, for to have you allow me to just speak for a while and kind of go through the sutra some more. and then we'll have a chance for some dialogue and questions. And also, let's just keep the form as we go into dialogue of raising hands for questions. And if a bunch go up, I will try to track names and we'll go in order, because as we know, this subject can get very exciting. I was up at Jikoji today giving the talk up there, and of course on mind only. We're just at the end of this practice period, we'll stop the mind only. We'll get into something else. But and it was hard. People, it was like the energy kind of got going. People were saying, "How can you deny substantial things?" And then also today I met this woman who is has had to leave her house because she felt that the smart meter, those new kind of wireless electric meters, was actually making her sick and actually crazy. And like, she's like, "I used to be really smart, but I've like lost all my brain cells are being killed by this smart meter." And I just tried very kindly and gently say, "Are you sure that the smart meter is causing this suffering?" She said she was really suffering too. And she said, she would just, the very questioning of that, she took great offense at, and said, like, I am so-and-so, and I am always right." And I said, "Oh, okay. Well, I hope that you're well. You can be well and free with this suffering situation." And I went away thinking, I really, with a renewed vow to not believe anything that I think. So as we get into this mind-only thing, I really don't want to believe anything that I'm saying or anything else. And I just, it's so clear to me how much suffering arises from basically believing anything. And I think that's what these teachings are about, is a highly complex way of saying, Buddha saying, "Please don't believe anything." Okay, with that, in mind, the sutra of the questions of Gunakara. It's chapter 6 here. I'm sorry, I don't have any more copies of the sutra, so if you can, you don't need to read along, you can just listen. So, Gunakara define the three characteristics. And I won't read that, but before we get into the sutra, I'll just read another version defining the three characteristics from a slightly different angle, because I think this is just nice, puts a slightly different twist on it. As I said earlier, this sutra has this one way of talking about these three characteristics, but the later tradition gets very creative and defines them in ways that sound completely different sometimes, but you can see how they're all keep being connected. They're not actually different. They're just, when you have three things together, you make a system of three different interactive things can get really dynamic. So I think any system that does that has that potential. So this is Asanga, the founder of the actual mind-only school, based on the sutra, his definition, what does it mean to understand these three characteristics? This is what's called the summary of the great vehicle, the Mahayana Samgraha. Asanga says, "In understanding that the images discriminated by mental words appear as objective, the bodhisattva fully understands the imputational character." So that sounds quite similar to what the sutra says. In understanding that the images discriminated by mental words appear as objective things, the bodhisattva fully understands the imputational character. In understanding the meaning of consciousness only, or mere concept, the bodhisattva understands the other dependent character. So this sounds a little different now. And it's kind of relating this term of mind only to the other dependent character. In understanding the meaning of consciousness only, which is a synonym for mind only, and another translation would be mere concept, the bodhisattva understands the other dependent character. I would say that is the other dependent character. And that's what, so up here we say, it says mere appearance of the world, and mind only, a mere concept. I mean, I did put it up there, even though the sutra doesn't say that. So we can look at it. The sutra says it's the dependent co-arising. When this arises, that arises. But we could see the dependent co-arising of the world is, in terms of mind only, is the mere appearance of things created by these eight consciousnesses. So even like colors and sounds and so on, as we might recall from the previous chapter, those objects, those mental objects, sense objects, are actually mind-made too. Colors are emanations of mind. And I think science might agree too. So that all our experience of the world is this mere, dependently arisen, mere appearance, or mind only. So that's the connection of this term mind only to the three characters. It's closely connected to, or maybe even equivalent to, the other dependent character. And Asanga makes that connection here. So in understanding the meaning of consciousness only, the bodhisattva understands the other dependent character. But how does she understand the thoroughly established character? By abandoning any idea about consciousness only. And there's even, I think, even different translations, they have an exclamation point at the end. So this is another punchline. So I think that's a really interesting way to put this. So the first one, this names, making objects out of things, is imputational. The fact that it's actually appearing as stuff, but it's not actually a real object, but just appearance of experience, is other dependent. And then, thoroughly established is abandoning any idea, or you could say thoughts, about mind only, thoughts about the other dependent, right? Because this is the absence of the imputational in the other dependent. The thoroughly established is the emptiness of the imputational in the other dependent. So this is just another way of saying, by abandoning all the thoughts about the other dependent, the thoroughly established is known. And as a meditation instruction, I think this is quite nice too. You could even see this as like kind of a three-part meditation practice. You could say, first you just understand how every thought connected with words or pre-words that's making a world of things is the basic delusion, reification of duality and so on, to notice how we're doing that. And then, if we do it in this order, then it's like, then we see, oh, actually, the appearance of things is not actually what I think they are. It's not the words connected with things, making them into objects. It's actually mind only. It's like a big step, actually meditating on, actually, there is all this appearance, and it's mind only. And you could say then, to bring that, then the next step, the deepening of the meditation would be like, don't even come up with a thought about mind only. Don't even, you know, if we, that's a conceptual meditation. All this is mind only. And maybe it's valuable to do that. I think it is quite valuable. But then to bring that into the deeper meditation, then let go of all thoughts about it and just then there's no more thingifying anything. There may be experiencing arising, but no things in a kind of non-dual meditation. So that's one order. You could meditate on imputation, all the kind of grossest, most solid delusion, then the other dependent where, oh, it's just appearances, and then see how we're still subtly kind of afflicting this other dependent appearance with our ideas of it, even to call it mind only, and then abandon all ideas about that. Or we could do the meditation as first meditating on the other dependent, it's because it's the simplest of them. Just first start, in fact, this is, we could do this as a more methodical, longer, drawn-out kind of guided meditation if we have time later, but just briefly, the way I've been trying to practice with this in Zazen is kind of like first just practicing mindfulness. Mindfulness, there's the four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of body, and which is actually the mind being aware of this object called the body. And it's not even so much body. I think actually mindfulness of body, in terms of this sutra, would be like mindfulness of physical sensation of the body. And I think we can do it with, especially in Zazen, sounds. Maybe if we leave our eyes open, a little bit of color. But we just, mindfulness of sensory objects as directly as possible is kind of like meditating on other dependent character, I would propose. And then, so we settle into that in a more and more present way, because all three of these are all about the present experience, and all meditation is also. So first we can just be mindful of the present experience of all these sense and mental objects. Thoughts arising and ceasing, we can be aware of that. And then, when we start to settle in more and more into the present, being mindful of the present experience like that, we could call it awareness of experience. We could call it other dependent, our experience, the present experience, experiencing, you could even say. And then, once we're settled in that, then start looking at, right in the middle of that, we're actually doing this, maybe quite subtle, if we're pretty settled, this kind of like naming things, or maybe not even naming, but feeling this sense of like, well, I'm here, I'm actually practicing mindfulness. There's somebody here aware of the body. We can feel this slight sense of separation, maybe big sense, maybe very slight. And actually, I'm hearing sounds, and even though I'm just mindful of the sound, I'm trying not to attribute too much storyline to the sound of the car going by, still, I can start to see there's some sense that it's very hard not to hear that sound as like outside the mind. Maybe the more and more we settle into the present, the more we maybe can actually start to hear sounds as like they're happening in the mind. But that sense of slight separation would be like the imputational character during meditation, even. And then to see how that's, you know, remembering the system, that that's not really, it's not really outside. And therefore to let go of that belief of externality. And this would be the point maybe of practicing mindfulness and actually letting go of any reifying thoughts. And even we might be doing a little, we might be giving ourselves a guided meditation like this. And at some point when it gets more and more clear, we let go of the guidance, right? Stop talking to ourselves about it and just be. Which is like not even experience, really. It's like we can't even say it's experience. We can't even say it's present anymore. So that's a kind of rough idea of some ways to actually bring this into Zazen. But I think the more we get the conceptual understanding, the more we can creatively and uniquely bring it into our own Zazen practice. So back to the conceptual description here. So now we have some metaphors. Gunakara, for example, the imputational character should be viewed as being like the defects of clouded vision in the eyes of a person with clouded vision. So I'll read through the whole metaphor first. Gunakara, for example, the other dependent character should be viewed as being like the appearance of the manifestations of clouded vision in that very person. Manifestations which appear as a net of hairs, or as insects, or as sesame seeds, or as a blue manifestation, yellow, red, or white manifestation. Gunakara, for example, the thoroughly established character should be viewed as being like the unerring objective reference, the natural objective reference of the eyes when that person's eyes have become pure and free from the defects of clouded vision. So this is about, you know, eye disease. I don't know how glaucoma works, but I think there's some eye diseases where, at least in India, where you'd actually see things in front of your eyes. There's this Indian term, sky flowers, that's used in a lot of the sutras. And it seems to be about this people thinking that they see flowers in the sky when they have certain eye diseases. So like little you know, specks that are actually on the eye, but they look like they're out there. So the imputational is actually like the defects of clouded vision, or the defective vision. One translation actually says of one who has cataracts. The Chinese, actually both, they say cataracts. So like the affliction of cataracts, the defective vision. I think we could also expand it to say it's the that's actually thinking that the sky flowers, that the that these things floating around in space, thinking that they're out there in space would be, I think it doesn't say that, but that's how I would interpret the imputational also. It's like believing that something's out there when it's not. But here it just says the defective vision. And the other dependent character is the appearances of manifestations of clouded vision. So as we say, it's mere appearance. It's it's the experience of sky flowers. It's like a mirage, as we talked about with these metaphors last time. The mirage actually appears, but it's not really water in it. So the other dependent is like the appearance of these manifestations of clouded vision that appear as, this is I guess what it maybe looks like, a net of hairs or insects or sesame seeds or these various colors that people might see. And then the thoroughly established is the unerring objective reference, or the other translations say the unconfused objects, or the unconfused sphere of operation natural to clear eyes without cataracts. So if we say that the thoroughly established is the absence, you know, this sutra is really defining it as the absence of the being real sky flowers in this appearance of sky flowers, or appearance of insects or something. But here it's defining it as the unerring objective reference. So in a way, we could say, like, if you're looking at space, if you're looking at the sky and you see these things, and you no longer believe these things are what they appear to be, then it's like you could say sky is the objective reference from when the person doesn't have cataracts. That makes sense? So that's one metaphor. Here's another one. Gunakara, for example, when a very clear crystal comes in contact with the color blue, it then appears as a precious gem, such as sapphire or mahanila. Further, by mistaking it for a precious gem, such as a sapphire or a mahanila, some kind of Indian gem. Sentient beings are deluded. When it comes in contact with the color red, it appears as a precious gem, such as a ruby, and by mistaking it for a precious gem, such as a ruby, sentient beings are deluded. Green, people mistake it for an emerald. Gold, color, people mistake it for a gold jewel, and so on. So, Gunakara, for example, you should see that in the same way as a very clear crystal comes in contact with a color, the other dependent character comes in contact with the predispositions for conventional designations that are the imputational character. So the clear crystal, this is like, it's nice because this metaphor is quite different than the previous one. It kind of brings out a different dimension. Instead of saying that the other dependent is these false manifestation appearances, it's saying the other dependent is like this clear crystal. Sounds quite different. So it's a clear crystal, but then when you put a color behind it, actually, to be accurate, it says the it sounds like the color. Well, it's a little funny here because it sounds like the clear crystal comes in contact with the color is like the other dependent character coming in contact with the predispositions for conventional designations that are the imputational. So it sounds like the color is the imputational character, but it seems to me more like the actual, like the ruby, seems more like an imputational character, right? Like that you believe that it really is a ruby, when actually it's just red, a red color behind the crystal. So, let's see. The Chinese one says, just as those tinted colors appear upon the pure crystal, so the propensity toward language of the characteristic pattern of clinging to what is imagined, that's their translation of imputational, is superimposed upon the other dependent. And the other one says, the coloring agent on the crystal is like the habits of description held to by conceptualization imposed on dependent existence. So that sounds better to me. It's not saying that the color knows to. It doesn't necessarily say that the color is the imputational character in the metaphor. It's about the it's about these, particularly about these predispositions. You can say the color is like the tendency to create, the karmic tendency to create solidity out of appearances. And about the interaction between them. For example, in the same way as a very clear crystal is mistaken for a precious substance, such as a sapphire, mahanila, ruby, emerald, or gold, see how the other dependent character is apprehended as the imputational character. So there, it actually, now it does sound like the imputational character is the ruby or the gold. So this could be, you know, some of the details might be lost in translation here. Gunakara, for example, you should see that the other dependent nature is like that of a very clear crystal. For example, a clear crystal is not thoroughly established in permanent time or an everlasting time as having the nature or having the character of a precious substance like a sapphire, mahanila, ruby, emerald, or gold, and is without the nature of such things. So this, I think, is quite interesting too, that it's using this term thoroughly established in this, you know, instead of just calling it the name of one of the characters, it's saying, it's talking about the relationship between the other dependent and the imputational is not thoroughly established. You know, the imputational being being the other dependent is not thoroughly established in permanent time or everlasting time. In fact, it's not established at all. The imputational is not thoroughly established as the other dependent. Now, what is the thoroughly established? It's that the imputational is not the other dependent. This is pretty tricky play with language here. but it's like one's like a negative of the other. They're saying the same thing, but it's nice there because they're bringing out a little different dimension by saying this is not thoroughly established as being this. This is thoroughly established as not being this. Can you follow that, Marie? This imputation is not thoroughly established as being the other dependent. The imputational is thoroughly established as not being the other dependent. So that's, you could see that's how this term came to be. And this thing about permanent, everlasting time is, I think they just seem to be emphasizing something about thorough establishment and the permanence of this not being this. So in the end, we find this thoroughly established character, which is emptiness. It's that this not being this is what we call the thoroughly established, and it's permanently and everlastingly thoroughly established as empty. So in some ways, we could say emptiness actually is permanent and everlasting. This is like our red flag goes up when we hear these things, possibly, but. And that the ultimate truth is permanent and everlasting. Like, wait a second, isn't that making it into some permanent, everlasting thing? I think it's playing with that and saying, actually, we can say that about the thoroughly established and about emptiness and suchness because it's not a thing. It's like, it's more about an absent, the way that this never meets this. That never meeting is always the case, eternally the case, that things are not what they appear. Things have never been what they appear and never will be what they appear. So it's just saying what's permanent is that something is not something else. Does that make sense? Emptiness is the fact that we can't find any substantial existence behind the words or any externality apart from mind. The fact that we can never, ever find it is thoroughly established. And it's dangerous, I think, a little bit to talk this way because it starts to sound like something is being thoroughly established. But actually what's thoroughly established, and permanent, everlasting time, is that this is not this. So it's not really a problem to say that, but it's just, they're pushing it a little bit here. In the same way, you should see that since the other dependent character is not thoroughly established in permanent time or in everlasting time as being the imputational character and is without its nature, it is the thoroughly established character. That's a neat sentence. Should I read that again? In the same way, you should see that since the other dependent character is not thoroughly established in permanent time or in everlasting time as being the imputational character and is without its nature, it is the thoroughly established character, but actually this is a one word that I think I'm proposing is a mistranslation. The word it. Because it implies to me that it's saying the other dependent character is the thoroughly established. It sounds like it's saying if the other dependent is not established as the imputational, the other dependent actually is the thoroughly established. And actually this is kind of a big and very subtle topic that maybe we'll save for chapter 7 because it comes up there again. And there's some people that I tend to agree with, like Jeffrey Hopkins, who seems to be really thoroughly studied this. He says, this is a common, I'll find the quote at some point, but he says, there's a common misunderstanding, he says, amongst contemporary Japanese and American scholars to interpret the kind of purified other dependent character as being the thoroughly established, almost like, and I think we often fall into that, but if you look at the language very carefully, except for this one sentence, it's not really saying that. We might think that if you take this appearance and it's overlaid with this with our ideas that it's really real, and you take away the ideas that it's really real, and you just have the mere appearance or mere concept, that's what we're looking for. That's the thoroughly established. We might interpret it that way. It sounds similar, but there's a small but distinction, but with a big effect, of saying it's not actually the other dependent minus the imputational, like a purified other dependent. It's the absence of the imputational in the other dependent. It's the absence that we're actually looking at. The absence is the thoroughly established. So, okay, well, because this is a tricky point, let's have some questions.
It seems like this is the exact point that people freak out about.
Mm-hmm.
Because in a way, what it does is erases or removes the subject-object dichotomy. It's an existential moment. If we're willing to accept that, we're basically willing to say, I personally don't exist. And that's a scary thing for people. You know, that's why people want to cling to an idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then not only is it saying that the subject-object dichotomy is erased, but then also following that causation is erased. So all that exists is the conditions.
How is causation erased from that?
Without subject-object, there is no causation. So then all we're left with is kind of an incomprehensible, interdependent condition.
Maybe we could also say that I think another point here is that the thoroughly established is the absence of the imputational. It's the absence, but that doesn't negate the other dependent character. It's just, again, I think it's really a great part of this is saying all phenomena have all three of these characters, whether we're deluded or totally enlightened. Still, if there's a phenomena, which means anything we experience, it always has all three of these. So it's not like when we realize the thoroughly established, it eliminates. Now there's some language in here that starts sounding a little bit like eliminating, but I understand it more that the thoroughly established is what we focus on. It's the object of observation for realizing suchness. But even if we realize the thoroughly established, still there's another dependent character, which is the mere appearance of me and causes and conditions. And so that never really gets negated. It's just that that's the nice part about this three-part model. It's not like saying when you realize emptiness, there's nothing left. It's saying, no, there's still, everything has an other dependent quality. It's not the ultimate truth. It's a conventional truth. But things really do appear, and therefore it's not like there's nothing left. But what's left is mere appearance. And there's this point that the mere appearance that's left is not the same as the thoroughly established. So to say realizing mind only, realizing that all this is just mind, is a little bit different than saying realizing the thoroughly established. You see how they're slightly different? They imply each other. They're very closely connected. But realizing the thoroughly established is more like realizing that all this that appears and is actually just mere mind is empty of substantiality. In other words, and that this, again, chapter 7 is going to like make this, the Buddha makes this explicit point about that the other dependent character or dependent co-arising or mere concept, or equating all those, is not the object of observation in meditation for completely realizing this either. You have to focus more explicitly on this absence. And I'll bring this up again, maybe in that chapter, but again, Jeffrey Hopkins puts it very nicely. He says, the reason this is so is because this delusion, this imputational delusion that things are what we think they are, is so deep-rooted and so all-pervading our experience all the time that we have to, it's more a practical thing in a way, I see it as, that what we have to focus on, or what's most helpful to focus on, is the explicit opposite, the explicit contradiction to our belief, to our deluded belief. If our deluded belief is inherent existence, or that things are what we think they are, then we should focus on that they aren't, the way that they're not, or the fact that they're not, as opposed to an implication of when we realize that things are not what we think we are, then we can see that all this is mere mind, or mere concept, or the other dependent. But if we just meditate on the other dependent, it's not strong enough to undermine this belief. It's like going right to the focal point. It's like the place that we're clinging. Look at the explicit opposite. He calls it, says, look, we have to focus on what is explicitly contradictory to the delusion, whereas other dependent co-arising is, you could say, implicitly contradictory. There's a certain truth to dependent co-arising, but it's not explicitly contradictory to the grasping of non-emptiness. And that's my understanding, too, of all these Prajnaparamita sutras. Why don't they just say, everything is interdependent on everything else. Instead, they say there's no eyes, no ears, no nose, no, 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 no. It's all just empty. Like, why don't they give a more positive take on things? And they're all the Diamond Sutras the same way. And this little proposition by Jeffrey Hopkins, to me, actually gives a good take on that. It's because it hits us right in the opposite point of, it's a lot harder to take hearing that there's no eyes, no ears, no nose, than to say, well, there's an interdependent eye, ear, nose, tongue. That's not so hard to take. And in fact, we hear it and it's helpful, I think, to hear, but it doesn't shock us. It doesn't undermine our held belief in quite the same way, because we think, that's actually nice. I'm an other dependent person, and I'm interdependent with everybody, and but I'm still can be me. So that's maybe kind of what Jean was saying. Yeah. Okay. So a little bit more here. So now we're into this. I think this is this really great meditation paragraph. The way that the three characters are known now. So, Gunakara, in dependence upon names that are connected with signs, the imputational character is known. And we could talk more about signs, but it's basically, it's like the signs of an object are like the way that we hook into it as an object, the way that we can get a hold of it. It's not actually that we're grasping like a floor, it's more like we're grasping the signs of a floor. And we do that by connecting the name floor to the signs of a floor. And we think when those fuse together, that's delusion. We think that actually what we see as the floor is the floor. Again, this is linguistic connection here. That the name actually is the floor. Name floor is the floor. Or you could say, as the article said, babies, before they even have the name, have the concept. There's something here. Even if we don't call it a floor. So in dependence upon strongly adhering to the other dependent, okay, no, that was in dependence upon names that are connected with signs, the imputational character is known. Since this, I'll read the Chinese here too, because this is such a nice paragraph. One says, the imagined pattern, this imputational, imagined pattern can be understood as caused by the interplay between images and words. Another one says, the characteristic of conceptual grasping, that's imputational, can be known through the association of names and characterizations. Okay, now the next one is about the other dependent. In dependence upon strongly adhering to the other dependent character as being the imputational character, the other dependent character is known. We did talk about this last time. I remember Kathy brought, do you remember this one? You were like, wait a second.
Oh, I'm trying to remember.
Because this is funny. Well, I think when we first hear this, it sounds like the way we know dependent co-arising is by grasping it as the imputational. And I was saying that I think a key word here is know. In order to know this flux of energy soup that we call the other dependent, we have to at least slightly name it and make it into something and actually grasp it. Like we say, this maybe again goes back to this point about how we think, oh, well, everything's interdependent, and that's very nice, but it doesn't really undermine our belief because we're just grasping this idea of, we're conceptually grasping the idea of interdependence, even though it's a great idea to grasp. And in fact, you know, we're grasping this whole sutra, we're grasping the thoroughly established by talking about it too. But we're, in a way, you could say we're grasping an other dependent appearance of the thoroughly established. Again, all of these three are completely working together.
Can you permit me a spousal moment?
Yes.
You said you're having a hard time believing that there's no external world. And you said it's more like not believing that there is an external world.
Uh-huh. Yeah. That, I forget if that was about this point here. It might have been. Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially the next sentence about the fairly established, right? So, in dependence upon absence of strong adherence to the other dependent character as being the imputational, the thoroughly established is known. So, again, the thoroughly established is known in an absence of grasping this as this. So, it's never going to give a chance to be like, you know it by this. It's always you're going to know the emptiness by non-grasping. But it's particularly linking, you know, a particular type of non-grasping. You're not grasping this as being this, or this as being this. The non-grasping, or not, in a way you could say, not grasping one as being the other. You could also say it as that, not connecting them. In a way, you have these three characteristics of all phenomena, and it's like just not confusing the three of them, in a way you could say is not grasping. And if we can see that everything, this book, has this other dependent character, no problem. I can't, you know, I actually, it's inconceivable, right? But I can get some idea of it by grasping it as being my idea of its other dependence. And then there's the imputational, that I really think it's a book, and I think all my ideas about it are right. I'm right about everything. And then the thoroughly established is just like, I don't know what it is. And like, I don't even know to say I don't know. It's like beyond all words and the ungraspable suchness, emptiness of this. And all three, and that doesn't negate the other two. I think again, that's the great thing about this is that all phenomena, as long as they're phenomena, they always have all three. And another nice meditation you can do is, I think I mentioned this before, is apply each of the three to each of the three. I think this helps to understand them, and it's very, I think it's like a kind of like for me, doing this is a kind of, I feel almost like a physical freedom doing that exercise. You could say it's kind of an intellectual thing, but we can actually go through it in a minute.
Yeah. Could you give an example of that, what you just said?
Like, applying all three to all three?
Yeah, with something really concrete.
Yeah, well, in a way, applying all three to all three is hard to do with something concrete because we're actually talking about this conceptual model now. Okay, so let's start with the other dependent character has, that's a phenomena, right? There's a phenomena called the other dependent character that has three characters. It has the other dependent character, which is the way that that concept is appearing, or we could even maybe say that the other dependent character of the other dependent character is just the other dependent character. But I think, more interestingly, the other dependent character has an imputational character, which is the fact that we can call it the other dependent character. Right? As soon as we and that's kind of what this, that one verse was about. As soon as we call the other dependent, use those words, now that's the imputational character. We've made it into it. We've grasped it as a thing. So does that make sense? That's the imputational character of the other dependent. Now, the other dependent character has a thoroughly established character, has the character of suchness, which is the absence of the words other dependent in this inconceivable other dependent. Now, the thoroughly established character has three characters. Emptiness as a phenomena has three characters, has an other dependent character, which is the way it appears. It's kind of tricky here. The other dependent character of the thoroughly established is, I think we could say that it's the way it appears. Actually, I don't know about this. My mind is kind of like jamming up around that one. If anybody has any ideas, you can try.
You have the not as it appears. Right? So
not as it
the negation of as it appears is a relationship.
Yeah, but the other dependent is the appearance. So is there an appearance of emptiness before we grasp it?
Not as it appears, there is other dependent characteristics.
To say that the thoroughly established is not how it appears, the other dependent is...
Because it's in reference to...
It's dependent on our mind.
It's in reference to mere appearance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, therefore it's dependent on mere appearance. Yeah, I think we could do it that way. Or we could also say that the thoroughly established emptiness is dependent on a mind to realize it. It's not like floating around in space. Is similar to that, but it's more easy to say there's an imputational character of the thoroughly established, which again is the same thing. As soon as we name it thoroughly established, it becomes something that's not it, and so we can't actually talk about it. And then it has its way that it's actually free of all our words about it. I think the most actually interesting and helpful meditation for me is the third one, to take the imputational character, has three characters. The imputational has an other dependent character. That, I think, at one point meditating on this, that's one that really, I felt like really hit home as like a really helpful thing, because it keeps seeming like we're trying to like get over this thing that's like I almost felt like I was reifying this imputation, like we can't get around it, and like how does this delusion come? It seems like it's just we're born with it, and it's just infusing everything all the time, just permeates everything, and then to see that it has an other dependent character means it's like it just like arises due to conditions. Particularly that part of it, that this delusion is not some like fixed, stuck thing, that this very subtle sense of all-pervading duality is just part of our karmic dispositions as sentient beings. It dependently co-arises, and therefore it's very workable. It's like it's not so stuck anymore, right? That it itself dependently co-arises, but as soon as we call it the imputational with that word, and then it becomes a solid thing, it's like, whoa, how can we ever like work with this? And even more beautiful, the imputational character has a thoroughly established character. The imputational character has this suchness aspect, right? This like deluded culprit that's like causing all the trouble is actually suchness and emptiness. It's like free of everything about it, you know?
Practice enlightenment.
There it is. We could also see practice and enlightenment as being like the other dependent and the thoroughly established. It's almost like practice is this manifestation that we have to embody our life. We have to like sit on a cushion. We have to do something. And right at the same time, there's this verification, right, of the thoroughly established, we could say, always at the same time, whether we realize it or not. There's it is so. We could play with that, you know. That's another very dynamic thing: practice and realization or verification, and how that could be like overlaid on these three characteristics. It's like we could say like each of those two. If practice has three characteristics, and verification of enlightenment has three characteristics, and you know. So you could say, oh, this is like highly theoretical, conceptual stuff, but maybe it's just the way my mind works, but for playing with these, the way they all interrelate like that, I feel like all these divisions and walls of the mind start to kind of like unfold a little bit more. And then, of course, we can apply it to specific things. I think mainly it's about I mentioned as a possible homework assignment, right? What are the three characteristics of like this and this and any phenomena, mental or seemingly physical, any experience really that we have throughout the day? It's a nice exercise to look at, and maybe actually liberating to even do this in a conceptual way, to like try to identify these three characteristics. So in dependence upon strong adherence to the other dependent as being the imputational, the thoroughly established character is known. Another translation is, the pattern of full perfection, the thoroughly established, can be understood as caused by the absence of grasping the imagined pattern upon the other dependent pattern. They're calling them patterns here. So let me just read one more. The perfect characteristic of reality can be known by not clinging to conceptions superimposed on dependent existence.
Yes. It's just the token that those statements you're making are the imputational and the other dependent of the thoroughly established. You're saying that three ways, and as you say it, the concepts are morphing into the other characteristics. The concept of the thoroughly established being the absence of the imputational character in the other dependent is itself a dualistic concept. You can't even talk about emptiness without being dualistic.
Without bringing up these other kind of things.
It's impossible for that character to exist without the other two.
In order
to even conceive of the concept.
And so that also goes back to the way that the thoroughly established depends. Yeah.
And unity is there again.
Yeah. And that the thoroughly established depends on the other two in that way. Which is nice too to remember when we talk about emptiness, as like sometimes we can start thinking of it as like, especially sometimes you hear things like, well, emptiness is like the source of everything. That can, maybe it's a kind of Taoist idea that it gives rise to everything. But in terms of, I think, Prajnaparamita and this kind of teaching, it's not some like kind of godlike source that, in a way, maybe we could say the other dependent is a little bit more like creation. But emptiness or the thoroughly established is, oh yeah, exactly. It's always in relation to something. It's like it's an emptiness of something. There's not like emptiness floating around in space. It's in relation to objects, and it's like a medicine for grasping, really. So it's like only in relation to grasping, otherwise there's no purpose of it anyway.
So the paradox is, the more thoroughly we experience the conventional world, the more thoroughly we are aware of the thoroughly established.
Yeah, I think Nagarjuna says something very similar to that, and it's important that all three are always in the present and always in about the present experience. So, to do this, I mean, we're kind of talking theoretically here, but in actually meditating on it, I think the most juicy meditations are the only ones, maybe, really, that work. I mean, when I'm saying these, applying the three to the three, that's a really conceptual realm that's interesting. But more importantly, it's about our present experience. And get to sort of tune in more and more closely to our present experience. I think that's what it takes. More and more intimate with what actually seems to be happening, and then start looking even closer and closer. We see, oh, wait a second, like, who's looking, and like, how am I, what's going on here, and how am I making this into something more than it is? So I think it's that's why mindfulness seems to be the basis. We have to start with that, and then it's more like this subtle way that mindfulness. Maybe we can say mindfulness is, at least usually, is infused very subtly with this duality, because we're saying it's mindful of something. If we're mindful of some object, like the body, feelings, mental objects, or dharmas, there's this subject-object relationship. So even though that's our way to start getting really present, and then this is going, a step deeper into that, and seeing how even awareness or mindfulness of objects, even if it's just the present experience without even naming it as such, it still has this way of like there's me aware of something. And maybe there's times in Zazen where that drops away, and but we don't know that it's happening. As soon as, if there's any little thing going like, oh wow, like I'm so present now. That's already like, and sometimes we go in and out of that maybe. Well, if we're really settling in, there can be a time where we're like, there's a little bit of other dependent coming in, a little appearance and a little imputation, but it can be very, we can catch it, we can watch it happening, and then just, okay, relax that, and poof, nothing's happening, and then maybe we panic for a second, like, get a hold of it somehow, like, okay, like, I'm here, I'm meditating, yeah, or like, that was really cool, or something. But,
I have a physical experience that made a point to this, on the submarine. We'd be underwater for long periods of time. And when the lights were red in the ship, we knew it was dark outside. So we had a sense it was nighttime. But there was no direct experience of nighttime.
Mm.
But we knew it was because the lights were red.
Which are just set by the clock.
Set by the clock. Mm-hmm. So the clock had a reality all of its own. The reason is because we went to periscope depth, night adapted, mm-hmm. for the most part. We knew it was night because the red lights were on, but the red lights were not night.
Mm-hmm.
But we had a sense of night.
Yeah. Imputed sense of night.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. And there's the, it's kind of like the crystal example. You put red behind this submarine atmosphere, and then you think that it's night.
Yeah. The red lights go on, everybody starts yawning.
But the clear experience of the submarine life is like is kind of free of day and night. But then it's like you put just a red light on there, and it becomes actual night. We think
everything quiets down. You can start to whisper. I mean, just the red light.
Yeah, I think many things like this, well, we could say that. Also, we're applying it. We can apply it to all these specific examples, but then also remember that it's actually everything is an example of all three. Mm. Every phenomena, all day long, even in our dreams, everything we have could call an experience. So, if there's something that's not an experience, then it's not a phenomena, actually. But so amazing that we can do this automatically. We can do this imputing thing 24/7. Yes, Janet?
No.
Oh, yes. Oh, hold on. Go ahead.
A few minutes ago, did you say something about pursuing the interdependent character of emptiness? Didn't you kind of raise that?
Yeah, yeah.
I was wondering, once you've reversed it, you say, okay, there's the object, the other dependent object out there. And then once you reverse the imputational quality, you recognize that and say, okay, that's dead. Now you have the object, and through reduction, you can understand its other dependent character is emptiness. Is that right?
It's more like all these three are, emptiness is really the thoroughly established. So it's more like you can see the emptiness of the other dependent, but they never become the same. It's never that other dependent becomes emptiness. And this is maybe this point, this actually I think this is a...
Seeing the character of the other dependent, seeing the empty character of itself.
Other dependent.
It's thoroughly established character of the other dependent object through reduction. You realize it's made of component parts. You see it as a cup, you realize the cup. Only labeled the cup, when in fact it's made up of its components.
Mm-hmm.
But its components are in nature.
I think we could say that in terms of these, the imputational would be thinking it's really a cup. Then when we break it into its parts and see, actually it's a mental projection onto these things, that it's not really a cup. I would say that's the other dependent appearance of a cup. It's now just a mere appearance of a cup. And then the thoroughly established is this, it's the hardest one to talk about because it's the way that it's not our imputation. It's an absence. So to even say the components that make up a cup, I would put in the other dependent category, and then to see that. So in that example, the thoroughly established would be the absence of true cupness in this appearance of a bunch of parts that collected together into what looks like a cup. That it's hard to talk about this part.
Yeah.
The thoroughly established is not the same as a purified other dependent, and as Jeffrey Hopkins says, maybe that's wrong, but because he says there's many contemporary scholars who do interpret it that way. Sometimes we think that if you just take this other dependent
emptiness is not the same as a purified other dependent.
Yeah, emptiness is not the same as a purified meaning purified of the imputational.
Okay, that's all that it seems to address that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's kind of hard part. Does that make sense to people?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what?
Yes, please.
To me, the third one, it's you just stop talking about it. You just drop it. You know, it's like for me, in my head, when I think about this, okay, I'm meditating, so the imputation knows where I'm believing it.
Mm-hmm.
Say I'm thinking this thought, that person is selfish.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why she's selfish, and she's always going to be selfish, blah, blah, blah. Then I start having some insight. Oh, this is this kind of co-created, co-arising thing.
Mm-hmm.
I start getting
that
some
your
insight.
Mind is,
I start recognizing that. But I'm still thinking it. I'm still working it. I'm still spinning it. Just the personal experience of them, the thoroughly established, is I drop the thought. I drop thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Just stop it. I just stop spinning the words. I stop trying to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
I stop trying to go whether this is good. It's good. I just drop it. And sometimes that's the hardest thing of all, especially since I'm on a really interesting insight track.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, I want to keep thinking this.
Yeah, so I think
that's the experiential level, that's the closest I can come to.
Mm-hmm. That sounds very much like the way Asanga talked about it. That we says, you know, that other dependent, you get down to the other dependent, is just all you see is this mere concept, and then not having any more ideas about mere concept is the thoroughly established. But I guess, so that may be so just the way you said it, and then, but a question that comes to mind is, how to even say this? Something like, is it important, I guess maybe another way to talk about this question that's arising is, if we just let go of our thinking any moment, which sometimes have the kind of a Zen approach, right? Like, forget us even setting this stuff up, just like, drop it all right now. Somehow I feel like there's a little difference in just doing that and actually we're dropping this particular kind of thinking or belief that things are what we think they are. And I think if we don't realize what's being dropped, we may not get the full effect of, you know, because I think a good example would be like to just, you can any moment, you can actually maybe just stop thinking just intentionally, but I wouldn't call that realizing emptiness. I think it's a very, this is a very specific thing, like kind of like Rich was saying, emptiness is in relation to this certain type of grasping things as being what we think they are. So it's that certain type of grasping that ceases completely. And so it's very close. And it may be that, like, well, any thought is grasping, actually. So just dropping any thought, isn't that the same? So maybe we can just keep an open question. And are those the same or not? And there's some, there's some texts that say, we have these, I'm thinking these Tibetan traditions are really nice the way they talk about this, because they have practices that are very much like Zen, like Dzogchen in particular, where sometimes they talk about, for yogis, you don't need to do a lot of analytical meditation. If you're just meditators, you just, you need a little bit of simple investigation about whether you can find your mind or not, maybe. Like we have these Zen stories. I can't find my mind. Well, it's pacified. Done. You know, and Tibetan tradition has this thing too. And then there's this analytical approach that you, and in the end, you have to do the same thing of just drop it all. And they say, they start comparing those, and they say, well, are these, you know, we honor this, like, this radical drop it all from the beginning tradition, or like Huangbo, right? Yeah, just stop all conceptual thought. And that's it, you're Buddha, right? And then you have this thing of like, do you realize what you're dropping? And so some of these classical Tibetan scholars are like, well, we really want to honor this yogic meditation tradition, and yet we have to be careful that it's not, I've talked about this point before in other ways too, that what's the difference between shamatha, where you're just letting go of all thinking, and actually the same thing in the end, you're letting go of all thinking, but you're realizing that actually almost like you're not even letting it go, it's just you realize that your thinking can't ever reach what you're thinking about, and therefore it just drops on its own. Something like that. One has a realization that comes from conceptual analysis beforehand, and one doesn't. And you could say, in the end, if the experience is the same, aren't they the same? These are different ways of talking about it. And my current take is that they're not exactly the same. They're both, like, in a way, they are the same, but maybe another way to say how they're not is, I don't even know if you're even catching what I'm saying, what I'm comparing here. You catch it? So another way of saying that they're not is afterwards, after such an experience. You know, you can deeply let go of everything and then just like, wow, what happened? And like that was really cool, or like I feel totally relaxed now, but I actually can't really say what that was. That was like grace or something. And then we just, but like this mechanism of delusion still is totally in place, because even though it was maybe released, we don't know that it was released. We don't even know we have it. So now, of course, habitual tendencies, it's going to kick back in again sooner or later, probably sooner. And then we don't realize. But if we kind of have the understanding, which is I see as the function of these kinds of classes, like we kind of get this conceptual framework for zazen, you could say. So then you can have a kind of direct experience maybe of this kind of thing, and then you have this context, like, oh, that was actually verified. Again, it's, you could say, you're verifying that the other dependent really is free of the imputational. It's not like we have to make it free of. You can verify that it's free of in a non-conceptual dropping moment. And then just after that moment, you're like, well, you can kind of like that verify that what the sutra was talking about. And like, and now, and maybe the function of that verification is then you what is it? Then that verification can infuse like daily life in a different way than if you just have a great sesshin or something, but then you're just back into deluded thinking. You're like, where did it all go? I feel like nothing. A week later, it's just like I'm back in the exact same stuff. But if we kind of like, oh, that kind of confirms something, and then maybe we can almost intentionally confirm it again and again. Then in daily life we're like, well, I really think this is a book, but like maybe I've been able to directly verify that it's not by understanding what that means and then actually meditatively doing that. So now like the other dependent's still really strong here and I'm knowing it by grasping it as the imputational, but like there's a part that like just doesn't believe it as much. That's one story.
Suzuki talks about a blue jay.
Mm.
There's a blue jay. I'm going to paraphrase here. Blue jay is obnoxious. And then, I'm a blue jay. In the sense of just a blue jay. Blue jay doesn't go away, but it's there. But it's, whether it's obnoxious or not doesn't matter. But there's a sense of unification of blue jay.
Right.
So, we're not going into some kind of a black gas place. Everything is still there, it's just that nothing has inherent meaning.
And that sounds like the purified other dependent, which actually is valuable, even though we say the purified other dependent isn't the thoroughly established. Still, the purified other dependent is that becomes our life. Maybe as a bodhisattva who's realized the thoroughly established, then they're back into the world of appearance, but it's a more purified appearance. In other words, they don't believe that it's the imputational. So that reminds me of a poem, a Zen poem, about in the end, it's like we're not negating the apparent world, which is, I think, partly why this kind of sutra and this system is said to be a response to Prajnaparamita that seems to just like wipe it clean. It leaves you no eyes, no ears. This says, we still, everything has this other dependent appearing quality. This is in the commentary on case 32 in the Book of Serenity. It's this national teacher, De Shao, said, crossing the summit of the mystic peak, this is not the human world. It's like in the realm of the thoroughly established, crossing the summit of the mystic peak. This is not the human world. Outside of mind, there are no things. Filling the eyes are blue mountains. This is like, again, outside of mind, there are no things. Filling the eyes are blue mountains. Kind of like, and if you read that whole case 32, you see it's a response to the main story in the case is a monk who seemed to be going too far into nihilism, and like, I don't see anything at all. And the teacher says, that's right for the stage of faith, but not for the stage of person. And he said, this is like the stage of person is when blue mountains fill the eyes again. But they're just appearance. But it's not like there are no mountains at all. Again, it's like, you know, first there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. first, that's, you can maybe do that here, right? First there's a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. I think that word, I think that's what that's talking about. Deity, So maybe we're almost at the end. Maybe I have a minute to finish it. Let's see. Maybe not. Bodhisattva Gunakar, when bodhisattvas know the imputational character as it really is with respect to the other dependent character, then they know characterless phenomena as they really are. So chapter 7, we'll get into this more, meaning that they know the imputational actually has no character. It's just completely illusion, completely imagination. So that will become more clear in chapter 7. Gunakar, when bodhisattvas know the other dependent character as it really is, then they know the phenomena of afflicted character as they really are. It's a little strange, but it's kind of like this thing of we only know the other dependent by grasping it. Therefore, we only know it by afflicting it with the other, with the imputational. It's kind of, the sutra's kind of giving a bad rap to the other dependent in these paragraphs, but we'll let it go. They know a phenomena of afflicted character. Gunakar, when bodhisattvas know the thoroughly established character, then they know the phenomena of purified character. Maybe it's just emphasizing the difference between these two, even though they're two sides of a coin in a way. It's kind of saying, but really, like, let's remember that our appearances are kind of afflicted because, like, we kind of, they're kind of like the imputational's right there with them, by, in order to know them. Whereas this is purification. This is nothing actually here. This is just emptiness, which is pure of all afflictions. Gunakara, when bodhisattvas know characterless phenomena as they really are with respect to the other dependent, then they completely abandon phenomena of afflicted character. When they've completely abandoned phenomena of afflictive character, they realize phenomena of purified character. So it sounds like they're abandoning this, but maybe it's like they're abandoning the connection between these two. The affliction of the other dependent by the imputational. Then they know the purified. Therefore, Gunakara, bodhisattvas know the imputational character, the other dependent character, and the thoroughly established character of phenomena as they really are. They know all three. Once they know characterlessness, which is another name for the imputational, there's nothing actually, it's a complete imagination. Characterlessness, the thoroughly afflicted, and the purified character as they really are, then they know characterless phenomena as they really are. They completely abandon the phenomenon of afflicted character. When they've completely abandoned the phenomenon of afflicted, they realize the phenomenon of purified character. This is how bodhisattvas are wise with respect to the character of phenomena. When the Tathagata designates bodhisattvas as being wise with respect to the character of phenomena, he designates them as such for this very reason. Then the Bhagavan spoke these verses. When one knows characterless phenomena, one abandons phenomena of afflicted character. When one abandons phenomena of afflicted character, one attains phenomena of pure character. Heedless beings, overcome by faults and lazy, do not consider the faults of compounded phenomena. Weak regarding stable and fluctuating phenomena, they are objects of compassion. So, Nenet, I think, brought this up about last time too, because the Chinese says, one of them says, if you do not know phenomena are signless, you cannot eliminate their defilement. When you do not eliminate their defilement, you ruin realization of subtle purity. If you do not see the faults of conditionings, indulging conditionings, you will hurt living beings. So it's more about here, like, you will harm others. Negligent of the stable and unstable, pitiful is the loss in missing one and reifying the other. The stable and the unstable. Pitiful is the loss in reifying this one, and missing this one and reifying this one. And the other Chinese says, if one does not understand things as unmarked, one will be unable to abandon defiled things. Not being able to abandon defiled things, one will obstruct the realization of wondrously purified things. This part's kind of hard. Not gaining insight into the sinfulness of all one's actions, one will be wild, sinful, and injurious to sentient beings. Sadly enmeshed in transient things, are they not people lost and pitiable? Interesting that, like, one's kind of referring to oneself. One's saying, these poor people who don't understand, and then one's saying, like, we're, like, in trouble if we do this, and we better watch out. So, and then that brought up this question about compassion, which we don't really have time today, but maybe we start next week with eight
so
compassion.
The strict adherence is a kind of a grasping thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Abandoning is kind of a loosening thing.
Well, it's interesting because in that part it said, it used that term strongly. We know this by strongly adhering to it as goodness, and we know this by, in the absence of strong adherence.
Yes.
And I think it's interesting to play with that word strong, because maybe we can weakly adhere to the other dependent as being imputational just enough to, like, walk out the door and know what's the floor and the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Weakly adhering to our ideas of what things are, meaning, like, I grasp it just enough to, like, be able to talk, you know, and like, feed myself and stuff. But, like, but strong adhering would be like, I really believe what I'm saying, and I really, like, have to eat this now, you know, and that's, you know, so maybe the sutra doesn't say that, but I like to think of this strongly, maybe we can weakly adhere, and maybe the Buddha did in order to talk to us. How else could he have used these words? Well, there are stories about that, but they're weird.
Where we say, don't worry, be happy.
Don't worry, be happy. So maybe we can do chapter 7 next time. And keep contemplating our, analyzing our experience in terms of these three characteristics. The more familiar, the more we can do it without a lot of words, maybe, and just seeing, oh, I think, I believe what's happening is what's happening. That kind of thing. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.